From New York, this is Democracy Now!
What we've done by the actions that we've taken is really not to rupture the relationship, but to recalibrate it, to be more in line with our interests and our values. And I think that we have to understand as well that this is bigger than any one person.
The Biden administration's defending its decision not to sanction Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for ordering the assassination of U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi, despite a U.S. intelligence report directly implicating the Crown Prince. While Biden is letting MBS get away with murder, he's sending a completely different message to Iran.
You can't act with impunity. Be careful.
Those were Biden's words after U.S. airstrikes in Syria killed at least 22 in an attack targeting Iranian-backed militias. We'll get the latest on both stories, then go to Washington, where the Democratic-controlled House has passed a $1.9 trillion COVID relief package, but it does not include a federal $15 an hour minimum wage.
An increase in the middle wage is a financial necessity for our families, a great stimulus for our economy, and a moral imperative for our country. With that view, it is therefore inevitable to all of us that the $15 minimum wage will be achieved.
We'll speak to Congressman Ro Khanna of California. Plus, we'll look at the bloody crackdown in Burma as the military junta kills 18 protesters in the deadliest day of the coup a month ago. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration will not sanction Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for the assassination of Washington Post columnist, the Saudi dissident Jamal Khashoggi, despite Friday's declassified intelligence report reaffirming the Crown Prince directly approved the killing. The U.S. instead announced travel restrictions on dozens of other Saudi officials. Biden is set to publicly address U.S.-Saudi relations today, though the White House says no new policy will be announced. This is Secretary of State Tony Blinken.
The relationship with Saudi Arabia is an important one. We have significant ongoing interests. We remain committed to the defense of the kingdom. So what we've done by the actions that we've taken is really not to rupture the relationship, but to recalibrate it.
The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killings said the U.S. should directly sanction bin Salman and, quote, take the lead in ensuring accountability. Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, is also calling for the Crown Prince to be punished without delay. Meanwhile, CNN's reporting the names of three men were removed from the Khashoggi report shortly after it was first released. We'll have more on this story after headlines, speaking with the son of a political prisoner in Saudi Arabia. Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine is starting to roll out across the United States after it received final approval of the Centers for Disease Control. Unlike the two other approved vaccines in the U.S. by Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech, Johnson & Johnson requires one shot and does not need to be stored in a freezer. This comes as health experts warn the recent decline in cases is slowing down as more states move to relax restrictions. This is CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky.
We may be done with the virus, but clearly the virus is not done with us. We cannot get comfortable or give in to a false sense of security that the worst of the pandemic is behind us. Not now, not when mass vaccination is so very close.
In Texas, people are reporting workers at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley vaccination clinic turned them away because they were undocumented, a move that's against state policy. In news from Washington, D.C., the House passed the $1.9 trillion stimulus bill early Saturday, which now heads to the Senate. In response to the Senate parliamentarian declaring last week that including a $15 an hour minimum wage increase goes against the rules of budget reconciliation, senators Bernie Sanders and Ron Wyden say they will push for an amendment to penalize large companies that pay workers less than $15 an hour. President Biden's meeting virtually with Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador today, where López Obrador is expected to ask the U.S. to share some of its coronavirus vaccine supply with Mexico. In Burma, mass protests continue today after at least 18 people were killed in anti-coup demonstrations Sunday, the deadliest day since the February 1st military coup, which deposed and detained de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Police fired live ammunition into crowds as Burmese forces steadily escalated their crackdown. One local group says 1,000 people were arrested Sunday, including journalists and medical professionals. Sunday's bloodshed followed the firing of Burma's ambassador to the United Nations after he denounced the military coup. This is Chow No Tun.
We need further strongest possible action from the international community to immediately end the military coup, to stop oppressing the innocent people, to return the state power to the people, and to restore the democracy.
We'll have more on Burma later in the show with scholar and activist Meng Zarni. In Hong Kong, Chinese authorities have charged 47 activists with conspiracy to commit subversion under the national security law. They were among more than 50 people arrested in January for organizing a primary vote to choose candidates for a legislative election in the hopes of forming a majority bloc of lawmakers opposed to one-party rule. If convicted, the activists face life in prison, up to life in prison. In Iraq, at least 4 people were killed and 120 injured Friday after security forces in the southern city of Nasiriyah opened fire on people protesting the deterioration of public services. Residents are demanding clean drinking water and regular electricity in a city where most residents face polluted water and just a few hours of power each day. In Nigeria, 42 people, including over 24 students who were abducted by an armed group last month from a school in the north central state of Niger, have been released. This comes as local authorities continue to search for over 300 schoolgirls taken by armed men last week in a raid at their boarding school in the northwestern state of Zamfara. At least 15 refugees drowned off the coast of Libya after their boat capsized Sunday. This is the second refugee shipwreck in the Mediterranean in less than 2 weeks. The rubber boat was carrying over 100 people, including children, trying to reach European soil. According to the United Nations, more than 20,000 refugees have died in the Mediterranean since 2014. Back in the United States, Donald Trump made his first public address since leaving the White House, receiving a standing ovation as he delivered the keynote address to the annual CPAC, that's Conservative Political Action Conference, in Tampa, Florida, Sunday. Trump renewed his attacks on immigrants and repeated the lie that the 2020 election was stolen from him. He said he would not form a third party and hinted he might run again in 2024's Republican presidential primary. In immigration news, all asylum-seeking families who had been detained at the Berks County ICE jail in Pennsylvania have been released. The jail had been accused of abusing prisoners. In 2016, an ICE employee was convicted of sexually assaulting an asylum seeker while she was detained at Berks. Immigrant justice advocates have been fighting to abolish family ICE jails for years, a practice that was expanded under the Obama administration. This comes as 2 other controversial ICE jails for asylum-seeking families, Dilley and Carnes in Texas, will reportedly now be used as, quote, reception centers while families receive a COVID-19 health screening and shelter arrangements are made. Members of the Asian American community, allies and elected officials rallied in New York City Saturday to call for more action in the face of increasing anti-Asian hate crimes. This is New York Congressmember Grace Meng.
We've been taught our entire life to just fit in, just be quiet, don't speak up, be invisible. If you are invisible enough, you will be seen as American. But we are here to say that we will be invisible no more.
No more!
We will speak up.
Speak up!
The rally came after at least two more attacks against Asian Americans were reported in New York. Last week, a 36-year-old Asian man was stabbed while walking down the street, and 61-year-old Filipino-American Noel Quintana, who spoke at Saturday's action, was slashed across the face while on the subway last month. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has been forced to apologize for what he claims were misinterpreted comments after a second former aide came forward over the weekend to share her story of being sexually harassed by the governor. Charlotte Bennett revealed to the New York Times that Cuomo told her he was open to relationships with younger women and complained about being lonely and being unable to hug anyone because of the pandemic. Bennett said, quote, "I understood the governor wanted to sleep with me and felt horribly uncomfortable and scared," she said. Last week, former aide Lindsay Boylan said Cuomo kissed her on the lips without her consent, among other things. New York Attorney General Letitia James has been charged with selecting an independent investigator to look into the allegations. In Mississippi, residents of Jackson have spent nearly 2 weeks under boil water orders after a February cold snap burst pipes and left thousands of people without reliable access to running water. The crisis has cast a new light on Jackson's crumbling infrastructure, with Mayor Chokwe Lumumba warning it could cost over $1 billion to fix the city's aging water system. And in Philadelphia, supporters of renowned political prisoner and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal gathered Saturday across from City Hall, demanding the medically vulnerable 66-year-old be released from prison after he started experiencing symptoms of COVID-19. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal's grandson.
They want to bury my grandfather's name in the fight for black liberation. They want to bury that. We ain't gonna let them bury that.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. intelligence agencies have confirmed Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman directly approved an operation to assassinate Washington Post columnist and Saudi dissident Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. On Friday, the Biden administration declassified an intelligence report about the murder inside the consulate in Istanbul. But President Biden decided not to sanction the Saudi crown prince, who has been a close U.S. ally. Instead, the United States announced travel restrictions on dozens of other Saudi officials. CNN's reporting the names of three men were removed from the Khashoggi report shortly after it was first released Friday. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Executions, Agnes Kayamard, criticized the Biden administration's response.
I am disappointed by the lack of material information and evidence included in that report, and I will be very disappointed if there is no action taken, having recognized the primary role played by the Crown Prince.
President Biden spoke Friday to Univision and claimed he would hold Saudi Arabia accountable for human rights abuses.
We are going to hold them accountable for human rights abuses, and we're going to make sure that they, in fact, and if they want to deal with us, they have to deal with it in a way where human rights abuses are dealt with. And we're trying to do that across the world, but particularly here. This report has been sitting there. The last administration wouldn't even release it. We immediately, when I got in, found the report, read it, got it, and released today. And it is outrageous what happened.
We're joined now by two guests. Congressman Ro Khanna is a Democrat from California, member of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform. And Abdullah Alode is the research director in the Gulf at the organization Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN. The organization is the brainchild of Jamal Khashoggi. Alode was a friend of the late Khashoggi. He, his father, has been held in solitary confinement in Saudi Arabia since 2017. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Abdullah Alode. Can you respond to the report's release, what you found most significant about it, and the Biden administration response?
Well, thank you so much for having us. It's a pleasure to be here again. The report was no surprise. There was no new information. We already know that Mohammed bin Salman was implicated in the murder. We just needed that report to be released, and we think it's a huge step toward transparency. But also, we think it's equally important to follow that with a step toward accountability, which is as we knew now, Mohammed bin Salman is implicated in the murder. It's important to not just point finger, but fingers, but also to sanction MBS Mohammed bin Salman and to treat him as the pariah he is, like Biden promised during the campaign.
I want to turn to Joe Biden speaking in November 2019 during a presidential debate.
President Trump has not punished senior Saudi leaders. Would you?
Yes. And I said it at the time. Khashoggi was, in fact, murdered and dismembered. And I believe in the order of the Crown Prince. And I would make it very clear, we were not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them. We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are. There's very little social redeeming value in the present government in Saudi Arabia.
Congressmember O'Connor, were you surprised by the Biden administration response? This seems to be a reversal of what candidate Joe Biden wanted to see happen.
Well, candidate Biden's statement was very strong. I'm glad that they have released the report, but they need to follow that up with concrete action. At the very least, MBS shouldn't be allowed to come to the United States. He still has the ability to come to the United States. They need to make it very clear that we're going to stop any arms sales to Saudi Arabia. They have done a good thing in stopping offensive support for the war in Yemen, but it needs to go much further. And finally, they need to demand that the Saudis lift the blockade and stop funding the groups in Yemen that are fueling the civil war.
You say that the Biden administration has frozen the military weapons that would go directly to attack Yemen. But this isn't permanent. I mean, the language was there. But what has Biden actually done to stop it? And what do you understand about that freezing of the weapons, how long that will be?
My understanding is that they have made it clear to the Saudis that the administration is not going to support in any way a bombing into Yemen, that any bombing into Yemen is going to be considered an offensive assault. The Saudi explanation that they're doing that for defensive reasons isn't going to hold water. The challenge is that the coalition bombing in Yemen continues, even without any United States support. And the Saudis continue the blockade. They continue funding groups in Yemen that are fueling the civil war. So we have a much larger obligation to put pressure on the Saudis to bring this war to an end, which it's important to remind people is the reason that Khashoggi was assassinated. He really was assassinated because of his courage in pointing out the intolerable, unconscionable suffering of people in Yemen.
So this issue goes from holding the Saudi regime responsible for the dismemberment of one man, of the Washington Post columnist, Jamal Khashoggi, quite literally his dismemberment, to the dismemberment of an entire nation, to Saudi, to Yemen, the horror of both. Now, the Saudi Foreign Office issued a statement saying, quote, "The government of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia completely rejects the negative, false, and unacceptable assessment in the report pertaining to the kingdom's leadership and notes that the report contained inaccurate information and conclusions. The kingdom rejects any measure that infringes upon its leadership sovereignty and the independence of its judicial system." Abdullah Al-Ode, can you talk about what directly implicates Mohammed bin Salman and also the timeline? It says the planning of this murder of Khashoggi goes back to, I think it was September 28th. He was murdered on October 2nd as he walked into the Istanbul consulate in Turkey, the Saudi consulate, to get papers for marrying his fiance and was literally sawed apart.
Well, first of all, the killing team and the mastermind of the killing team is the rapid intervention force that actually created personally by MBS and was tasked with protecting MBS and operating under not just his watch but under his direct orders. That's one thing that the report of the ODNI actually confirmed. Second, the team were actually the team traveled with two private jets owned by MBS and was actually confiscated by MBS just a few months before the murder. And then the company that was used actually was again taken from one private individual in Saudi Arabia to MBS himself and was used in the operation. And thirdly, the contradicting narratives of the Saudi government and MBS personally showed how, from the very beginning, this was premeditated, and sending the forensic expert with them with a bone saw is just a material, a direct evidence of their premeditation. And how they pre-planned the whole thing is just not could not be an accident if you send in somebody whose sole expertise is to dismember people. This is not an accident.
Abdullah Olada, what do you want to see happen right now? And what do you think would most affect the royal family in Saudi Arabia? What would send the message the strongest?
Well, I want to make a few points here. One is that Saudi Arabia is not MBS. If they want to, as Blinken said, wants to still have some kind of relationship to and partnership with Saudi Arabia, well, Saudi Arabia is not MBS. Saudi Arabia is the Saudi people in the first place, the Saudi institutions. And you can make, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, alternatives within the Saudi even royal family, and all of them are actually in jail. So they can start with releasing them and protecting them. That's one. Second, I think sanctioning MBS is by itself the strongest message, one for accountability, and this is a rule of law and justice, and second for other actors within the Saudi institutions to rearrange the succession order and to have somebody who does not have blood in their hands, and look at the MBS in the past, only in the past 3 years. He started the worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen by waging a war. He blockaded Qatar for almost 3 years. He put the prime minister of Lebanon under house arrest. He cut relationship with Canada over a tweet. He arrested prominent women human rights defenders, lawyers, scholars, economists, and put them in jail. This is only in the past 3 years. So imagine if you allow this guy to be a king and rule for the next 40 years, what would happen? It will be much more disastrous than this. He is now just the de facto ruler and crown prince, and still possible. The crown prince office, the position of the crown prince has changed 4 times only in the past 4-5 years. So it's still possible. It's something that the United States, can help with rearranging the succession by sanctioning MBS and making it difficult for his team and his for his force to just use the international stage as a theater for their or for their own butchered operations.
Congressmember Khanna, can you respond to that? What you think the Biden administration should do, as Biden is also addressing this today, and the kind of message this sends to the world when, to the credit of President Biden, this report was released, the Trump administration suppressed it. But then following up on a literally documented murder, the president moves on to say we're going to have travel restrictions on other members of the administration.
Well, I agree with what both of you have said. There is no way we can have a report released where there is direct implication of MBS ordering the brutal killing of Khashoggi, and we know all of his offensives internationally, and continue to have him be held with no accountability. So sanctioning him, making it clear that he's not allowed in the United States, will hopefully have an impact on the Saudis thinking about someone else in the royal family to assume leadership. That's their decision. It's not our decision. But our decision is to make sure that the MBS is held accountable, as I would argue any person, head of state or a senior leader around the world should be held accountable if they are directly implicated for murder and killing.
And finally, Abdullah Al-Oda, if you can describe where your father is right now and why he has been imprisoned.
He is in solitary confinement since September 2017. They arrested him a few hours after he tweeted calling for reconciliation between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. They actually tortured him. They deprived him from medications and sleep for a very long time until he went really, really sick. I was hospitalized a few times, lost half of his hearing and half of his vision because of medical negligence. He was mistreated all along. All the family is banned from traveling. 19 members of my own family were banned from traveling and used against me to intimidate me and threaten me abroad. And also they froze my account and froze my passport and asked me to go back to Saudi Arabia. They transferred my father to the specialized criminal court. And they charged him with 37 charges, including corrupting earth by seeking to change the Saudi monarchy into democracy, and having books that are banned in the kingdom, and being sarcastic about the government achievements, and very preposterous charges like these. And they are seeking the death penalty, and still seeking the death penalty against him because of these actions.
And, of course, we will continue to follow your father's case as well. Abdullah Al-Ola, I want to thank you for being with us. Director for the Gulf at Dawn, that's Democracy for the Arab World Now, speaking to us from Washington, D.C., a friend of the late Saudi Arabian journalist and dissident activist Jamal Khashoggi. And, Rokana, we'd like to ask you to stay with us as we're going to move on to talk about, well, while President Biden's letting MBS get away with murder, he's sending a very different message to Iran. We'll talk about the bombing, the U.S. bombing in Syria. Stay with us. Singing Motherless Child. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn now to Syria. The Biden administration's facing intense criticism after U.S. Air Force fighter jets bombed eastern Syria Thursday. The Pentagon claimed the strikes targeted Iranian-backed militant groups. The London-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reports at least 22 people died. Biden ordered the airstrike on the same day he spoke with the King of Saudi Arabia, Iran's arch-rival. rival in the region. According to the White House, Biden committed on the call to helping Saudi Arabia defend its territory from Iranian-aligned groups. The Pentagon called the assault a response to recent rocket attacks on U.S. forces in northern Iraq. Those attacks came more than a year after Iraq's parliament voted to expel U.S. troops, an order that's been ignored by both Trump and Biden. On Friday, Biden was asked about the airstrikes.
Mr. President, what message were you sending to Iran with your first military action?
You can't act with impunity. Be careful.
Still with us is Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna of California. We're also joined by Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the new think tank, the Quincy Institute. His most recent book is titled Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Trita Parsi, can you respond to the attack, the U.S. bombing of Syria?
Yes, the Biden administration, I think President Biden himself specifically felt strongly that because of the attacks in Iraq earlier, that a response was warranted. But what I think many people are fearing is that very quickly the Biden administration is falling into the same old patterns of before, of responding to this and that without having a clear strategy that actually would extract us from these various conflicts and actually pave the way for much more productive diplomacy. The idea that this actually would help us with the diplomacy with Iran, for instance, seems really difficult to understand, mindful of the fact that we are now in a situation in which the Iranians have rejected the offer from the Europeans to come to the talks precisely because of these attacks, because of other measures have been done, which means that these first 2 months of the Biden administration that could have been used for really productively laying the groundwork for new talks seem to instead have been used to just fall into the old patterns. And this is quite concerning because at the end of the day, reviving the JCPOA is another promise that the Biden administration gave during the campaign and said that it would pursue diligently.
Were you surprised by these attacks? And explain exactly where they took place in Syria.
It took place in the eastern part of Syria. These are various groups that the Biden administration describes as pro-Iranian, certainly seem to have a degree of support from Iran, whether they're under the command of Iran. It is not as clear. At the end of the day, the fact that this was said the same day as the Biden administration decided not to pursue sanctions on MBS, again, seems to suggest that the Biden administration is more concerned at this point of making sure that it doesn't upset certain allies in the region, doesn't pay a political cost at home for pursuing compromise with Iran over the nuclear issue, which I think sends a very, very concerning message. Because at the end of the day, in order for the JCPOA to be revived, both the Iranians and the U.S. side have to give compromises, and they're going to have to pay a political price at home. The Obama administration did so. The Rouhani government did so. There is no escaping from that. But if at already this stage we're signaling that we're not ready to do so and we're too concerned about those political costs, that really sets a question mark as to whether the political will exists for seeing these negotiations on the nuclear program come to a completion.
Congressmember Ro Khanna, your response to the bombing of Syria.
Well, this is not an ambiguous case. The administration's actions are clearly illegal under the United States law and under international law. We do not have any authorization of military force to go into Syria. In fact, President Obama tried and then backed off in getting that authorization. We do not have any authorization of military force to attack Iran. The idea that this was an imminent attack on U.S. self-defense are simply not borne out by the facts. And under international law for self-defense, we have to go to the United Nations. The administration did not do that. So my concern is that this president ran on ending endless wars, ran on respecting the United States and international law, and these actions clearly violate both.
So, Trita Parsi, if you could talk about the European Union, Iran rejecting an offer by the EU to hold direct talks with the U.S. on the nuclear deal after the U.S. attack on eastern Syria, the significance of this.
It's a very unfortunate decision by the Iranians. I mean, I think it would have been much better if they accepted this invitation. But at the same time, it is not a surprising decision. In fact, one of President Biden's own senior officials, Wendy Sherman, who is now going to be confirmed next week or having hearings to become the Deputy Secretary of State. She was a lead negotiator under Obama for the nuclear deal, said in 2019 that the idea that the Iranians would come to the table and talk to the United States without some sanctions relief, meaning that the United States would continue to violate the JCPOA and yet the Iranians would come, was extremely unlikely. It's not clear to me why the Biden administration has chosen a strategy that some of its own senior officials earlier on had deemed to be extremely unlikely to succeed. So it's not surprising. It's very negative. And now we're in a worse situation. There's going to be a fight potentially today at the IAEA Board of Governors about whether to censor Iran for some of its reductions of obligations under the JCPOA, while the United States continues to completely disregard all of its obligations. So these are all the type of wrong measures and steps that should be taken at this stage of diplomacy. At this stage, there should be goodwill measures. There should be positive signals of intent in order to create the best possible circumstances for diplomacy to start. Now we're having the opposite.
Can you explain, Trita, Iran's demand that the U.S. end sanctions before returning to negotiations? Explain what the U.S. sanctions against Iran are and how they're affecting the people there.
Well, the Iranians have now suffered tremendously under sanctions that President Trump put in place in 2018 and 2019 and onwards. These have been devastating to the Iranian economy. In fact, President Trump intensified those once COVID broke out, seeing the pandemic as a way to further enhance the impact of sanctions. And this means including blocking Iran's ability to get IMF loans for the purpose of fighting the virus. So the Iranians have suffered tremendously under these sanctions for the last couple of years. I think part of the reason why they're fearful of going to the table without getting some indication. Not all sanctions need to be lifted from their perspective, but some indication that the U.S. is going to lift sanctions is that otherwise they fear that the talks may not succeed. They will get blamed for the breakdown of talks. They will be seen as being at fault, even though the United States under Biden has not changed Trump's position of maximum pressure. So the U.S. doesn't even come back into the deal, but manages to shift the blame onto the Iranians. I think this is part of their fear. I think at the same time, demanding that all sanctions be lifted, which they did earlier on, is completely unrealistic. What is happening right now is that the Iranian demand is that the U.S. side promises that once the U.S. is inside of the deal, it will lift sanctions. But it's also very difficult to see how the U.S. could reject that, mindful of the fact that once it is inside a deal, it has to lift the sanctions. Otherwise, it will be in complete violation of the deal.
Ro Khanna, if you can talk about the timing of this attack. All week, the buildup to the release of the report on the murder of Khashoggi and the clear connection to MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. So all of that was building. Then the President Biden says he's speaking with the king, and they talk about defending Saudi's borders. And just before the release of the report, they bomb Syria, and they talk about attacking Iranian-backed militias, the major enemy of Saudi Arabia. Can you respond to this, this idea that they are releasing a report that proves the murder of Khashoggi is the crown behind it, is the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, but then they do Saudi Arabia's bidding?
Well, Amy, this is why the Constitution says that before a president takes these actions, they have to come to Congress, because those issues would have been debated in Congress. Questions would have been asked. Is this in any way in response to conversations with the Saudis? Why do we need to take this action now? Why is it that suddenly we feel that there's an imminent threat? Is this action going to be escalatory? They're saying that the action is de-escalatory. I haven't understood how. How is a military strike de-escalatory? And the main point here is that the maximum pressure campaign has not worked. Iran's enriched uranium was about 102 kilograms when President Trump took office. It is 2.5 tons now. It is 25 times more. So repeating this continued strategy not only has implications for our staying entangled in the Middle East, it actually has not worked in the objectives. And the challenge is a naive view in the United States that somehow our actions are going to force regime change in Iran. If anything, they're entrenching the regime. We need a totally different approach. And I actually think the American people want a totally different approach.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Trita Parsi, thank you for joining us with the Quincy Institute. I also want to thank Ro Khanna and ask you to stay with us because a lot has happened in the House where you're a member from California. We want to ask you about the $1.9 trillion pandemic relief package. The House has included the $15 an hour minimum wage, but it will be stripped out. Get your response to that and other issues. Stay with us.
Minimum wage! Yeah!
Minimum Wage by They Might Be Giants. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a party line vote, the House voted Saturday to pass President Biden's $1.9 trillion pandemic relief package, which includes $1,400 stimulus checks to people who make less than $75,000 a year, as well as funding for expanded unemployment insurance, vaccination programs, school reopenings, and more relief for small businesses. The package also includes a measure to increase the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $15 an hour over 5 years, which could now be stripped out as it heads to the Senate after the unelected Senate parliamentarian ruled it does not comply with budget rules around reconciliation. In response to the Senate parliamentarian declaring last week that including that $15 an hour minimum wage increase in the package goes against the rules of reconciliation, Senators Bernie Sanders and Ron Wyden say they'll push for an amendment to penalize large companies that pay workers less than $15 an hour. Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona have also said they'll oppose the $15 an hour minimum wage, despite the fact that the people of their states support it. The White House said Biden would respect the parliamentarian's decision, but progressives are pushing back on this. For more, we go to Ro Khanna, Democratic congressmember from Silicon Valley in California. Your response to what happened, and explain exactly what this part of the bill is that you passed in the House and what is going to happen in the Senate.
Amy, at the heart of what Democrats stand for, it's giving working class Americans, middle class Americans, a raise. The minimum wage is at $7.25. I don't know any part of this country where someone can survive on $7.25. The bill we passed says it needs to be raised to $15. It's a gradual raising. The $15 isn't until 2024. Many states already have $15 laws. As you pointed out, this is popular in both blue states and red states. Florida passed recently a $15 minimum wage. The reality is that we will not be able to get this done unless we do it through reconciliation or eliminating the filibuster. We simply don't have 10 Republican votes. And that's why we believe that we need to have this part of the reconciliation package in the Senate. The parliamentarian, though a person, in my view, of integrity, misruled or gave a false opinion in this case. I believe the minimum wage clearly has a budget impact. If you raise people's wages, they will pay more taxes. It certainly has more of a budget impact than the repeal of the ACA had, which the parliamentarian had ruled in order, in reconciliation. This is why ultimately the decision belongs to the Senate chair. That is either the vice president or someone the vice president designates. There is precedent for not listening to the parliamentarian's advice, and we are hopeful that the vice president or whoever is in the Senate chair will do that in this case.
Explain that, Congressman Khanna. Explain exactly what can happen and what that precedent was, a previous vice president.
So parliamentarian Robert Dove, it's worth listening to his entire testimony. It's on YouTube video. Basically explains that Hubert Humphrey often disregarded the parliamentarian when he was vice president. Nelson Rockefeller in 1975 famously disregarded the parliamentarian to bring the threshold required for overcoming a filibuster from 67 votes, which is what it used to be, down to 60 votes. So we've seen clearly that there is a pattern of the vice president's overturning or disregarding the parliamentarian, especially when there are procedural issues regarding the filibuster. The vice president here can do the same thing, and or whoever is in the Senate chair, and that would allow the $15 minimum wage to be in the Senate package. Now, people say, well, you already have a couple senators who are going to vote against it anyway. First of all, people often say one thing. It's very different to vote against the president's first major initiative. I don't think they will sink the entire COVID deal over this issue. Secondly, if we're even going to have compromise or negotiation with senators who may disagree with the $15, we first have to rule it in so they have an incentive to negotiate, understanding that it can be part of the reconciliation package.
So you have people like Raphael Warnock, who won but has to run against again in 2 years from Georgia. It's wildly popular in Georgia, $15 an hour. You have Mark Kelly, Arizona. It's popular in Arizona. He also runs again in 2 years. The significance of these Congress members, these senators like Manchin, where it's popular in West Virginia, he's now proposing $11 an hour minimum wage, but that this is bipartisan, multipartisan, $15 an hour is supported across the country.
It is, and it's a moral issue. I think people recognize with the extraordinary wealth generation that we've seen, especially in the pandemic, where districts like mine in Silicon Valley, many have done extraordinarily well because of the digitization of the economy, made trillions of dollars, that we can afford in this country for every person to make at least a $15 wage, that can be and should be the floor. This is one of the few issues that has broad support across the political spectrum, and it is something that we must deliver on because of our core principles and because it will help us mobilize people that we need to continue to maintain our majority and continue to succeed politically.
What that means, right, for Democrats to maintain the majority is respond to what most people want. I think Politico shows 76% of Americans, more than three quarters of Americans, back the overall bill, including 60% of Republicans, but not a Republican voted for it. And that goes larger than the $15 an hour. But I wanted to ask you about what other means of getting that passed, if it's stripped out of the Senate bill.
There are really only two means of getting $15. One is to make sure that it's in reconciliation. If it's not in this reconciliation, it would have to be in a second reconciliation. But at any point, that requires disregarding the parliamentarian, because the parliamentarian is not going to change their view on whether minimum wage should be in reconciliation. So either you have to overturn the parliamentarian, or you have to eliminate the filibuster. Otherwise, there is simply not a path to getting $15 minimum wage.
And what does eliminating the filibuster mean?
Eliminating the filibuster means that it would take a 51 votes to pass any major bill in the Senate. And right now, of course, it takes 60 votes. Adam Gentleson has a brilliant book which explains, and I didn't understand the history of the filibuster, but he explains that it was actually an invention of Calhoun, who used the 60-vote requirement to do the bidding of the slave states, and then it was invoked time and time again in the civil rights era to block civil rights legislation. And as I pointed out, actually, it's ironic that Nelson Rockefeller overrules the parliamentarian to try to lower the impact of the filibuster from 67 votes to 60 votes. But this history of the filibuster being tied to Jim Crow is important and highlights why we need to overturn it. Reverend Barber has said, I was talking to him recently, this is a moral issue of our time. The people who are often most affected with low wages are black and brown, many women. This is an issue of justice, and we cannot let these procedures stand in the way, illegitimate procedures stand in the way of what is just and right.
Do you think the $15 an hour proposal will die if it's not included in the Senate law, in the Senate bill?
Well, I mean, I'm never going to concede a defeat, and we will continue to fight. The next fight then would be, let's make sure it's in the next reconciliation. But I think this is a moment to act. This is our best chance for the reasons you mentioned. There are a lot of good things in this bill. They have aid for state and local governments, aid to help schools open, aid for vaccination, aid for children in poverty. And so in a bill that is so popular, that is our best chance of having minimum wage part of it at the height of the president's popularity, approval in his first 100 days. It is always the best chance to get meaningful legislation. One point, while the bill is tremendous in many ways, and I voted for it, and I will vote for the final package, whatever is in it. But the important thing is that the $15 minimum wage is not just 1 year. It represents a move towards structural change in this country about an economy that isn't working for people. And that's really the question. Do you believe that we need structural change in America for those left behind? I do.
Ro Khan, I want to thank you for being with us. Democratic congressmember from California, member of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform. As we end today's show in Burma, where mass protests continue today after at least 18 people were killed in anti-coup protests Sunday, the deadliest day since the February 1st military coup, which deposed and detained de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Police fired live ammunition into the crowds as Burmese forces steadily escalate their crackdown. One local group says 1,000 people were arrested Sunday, including journalists and medical professionals. Sunday's bloodshed followed the firing of Burma's ambassador to the United Nations, Chau Mo-Tun, after he denounced the military coup before the UN General Assembly.
We need further strongest possible action from the international community to immediately end the military coup, to stop oppressing the innocent people, to return the state power to the people, and to restore the democracy.
For more, we go to London, where we're joined by Meng Zarni, Burmese scholar, dissident, human rights activist, co-founder of the Forces of Renewal for Southeast Asia, or FORSI, a grassroots network of pro-democracy scholars and human rights activists across Southeast Asia. Zarni, welcome back to Democracy Now! Describe what happened over the weekend.
Well, the coup group and the entire security sector, including the hardcore light infantry divisions and the police force intelligence network have essentially terrorized the entire population. Amy, I think we need to redefine what is happening in Burma as a protest against the military coup, by the new military dictatorship. I've lived under the first military dictatorship for 25 years, and I have seen nothing, despite all the repression that was going on around me and the whole society. I have seen absolutely nothing like what is happening. We have a situation where the military coup group has unleashed unprecedented terror, not simply against people protesting against the coup, but people inside homes, people just standing by, not getting involved in street protests. So today, something unprecedented happened. The elected body called a committee representing people's Bidang Zuluto or the parliament declare the coup group terrorist. I have been pointing this terroristic aspect of the regime, and this committee representing the entire body of elected MPs not allowed to take their seats in the parliament on the 1st of February, calling this group terrorist. That followed another unprecedented act at the United Nations General Assembly briefing by the official representative declaring and characterizing the military as the existential threat to the country and the people. We have an extraordinary situation in Burma, not simply clash up between demonstrators and the armed forces.
We just also got word that Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel laureate, appeared in court today. She is one of those who was detained, very much lost a lot of that human rights. Her world-renowned status as a human rights leader because of her stance on the Rohingya, standing against the Rohingya. But there she was in court. The significance of this?
Well, Amy, I think, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi has remained an iconic and pivotal and indisputably the most, widely popular Burmese politician within the country, within the majority society. I totally, get the contradictions. And then to a degree, hypocritical element, to defend Aung San Suu Kyi when she failed to, defend genocide victims, the Rohingya people. However, I think what needs to happen, with Aung San Suu Kyi, as well as the societies revolting against the entire security sector, the armed forces and police and all the rest, is we need to decouple whatever Aung San Suu Kyi's criminal responsibility or culpability in international law with respect to the genocide against the Rohingya. There, as you know, there is a proceeding going on at the International Court of Justice, the Gambia suing or challenging the state of Myanmar, for violating the terms of the Genocide Convention. We need to decouple Aung San Suu Kyi and her role in the genocide from the people's, popular democratic will on the grounds that, people have the democratic right to pick their own government and to revolt against tyrannical regime, which we have in Burma. And secondly, we need to look at, the external actors beyond Suu Kyi and domestic politics that are involved in enabling and protecting this regime. The public have decided to call terrorist group. And, 3 o'clock in the morning in UK, I woke up. That's 9:30 in the morning. I saw Taliban-like situation, truckloads of infantry divisions, firing randomly on the empty streets, and people screaming inside their homes. And so we need to look at particularly China's support of this regime, and also look at Singapore's financing and investing. There are a lot of things that need to be unpacked. Terror financing, China flying flights carrying what is believed to be special forces into a sovereign country next door. The last 2 weeks, I would estimate between 5,000 to 10,000 Chinese special forces have been flown in unmarked, on unmarked aircraft carriers from Kunming, the nearest province of China, into Burma, in anticipation, perhaps paranoid, on the part of the Burmese government or military, that the U.S. might militarily intervene. These are really, really, relevant, issues in international law.
And what do you think the U.S. should do?
Well, President Joe Biden, I campaigned for it online, because what happens to the United States or in the United States matter around the world, and particularly matter for democratic struggles, particularly Burma and other places that are unfolding.
We have 10 seconds, Arnie.
Yeah. I think Biden should put his money where his mouth is. He said that democracy need to be defended at the Munich Security Conference 10 days ago. And Burmese people, millions, are out risking their lives. And Biden needs to follow up with action.
Mong Zarni, I want to thank you for being with us. Burmese scholar and dissident joining us from London. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wells. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe. Wear a mask.